Chapter 3. Footloose. In the drizzle of a gloomy day, the triumphal arch of Titus on Rome's Via Sacra can look strangely sombre. The yellowed marble of its enormous frame darkens to a lacklustre grey, rendering its high-vaulted ceremonial archway a bleak and brooding empty space. But beneath the arch itself, the celebratory monument suddenly springs into life. Gods, people, animals and architecture burst out of the bas-relief friezes decorating the passageway. On one side, Titus stands in a chariot pulled by four magnificent horses, as Virtus and Honus, the divine personifications of military virtue and imperial glory, lead the chariot along the processional way. Behind Titus stands winged Victory, crowning him with the oaken acorn circlet of triumph as he gazes towards the political heart of ancient Rome. Originally painted in bright bursts of colour, the monument was erected to celebrate Titus' emphatic defeat of a rebellious Judea, or Judah, in 70 CE, when he was still but a general, fighting under the command of his father, the Emperor Vespasian. The spoils of his victory are depicted on the opposite frieze. Here, a throng of Romans jostle their way along the Via Sacra, struggling under the weight of the sacred swag looted from the Jerusalem temple, a golden table for ritual offerings, its cup still perched upon it, the silver trumpets of the temple's priests, and a huge golden menorah. Of course, the Romans were not the first to monumentalise the capture of sacred treasures from the temples of the defeated, nor indeed the first to glory in the violation of a deity's dwelling place. But it's the indignity inherent in the dynamic display on the Arch of Titus that distinguishes it from the visual propaganda of earlier imperial cultures. Tottering on their makeshift pallets amid a crush of bodies, the Jerusalem temple's prized possessions are not so much glorious trophies, but objects of derision. The contrast with the celebratory art of the conquering kings of older cultures is striking. The mighty emperors of Southwest Asia were no less triumphalist in their exhibition of looted temple treasures, and no less destructive in their despoliation of the divine, but they tended to afford a certain dignity to their sacred booty, publicly at least. Ancient precursors to the iconography of the Arch of Titus can be seen on the monumental wall panels decorating the ceremonial rooms of later Syrian palaces. Here, soldiers marching with regimented precision carry aloft their holy cargo with reverent care as their comrades continue to bludgeon, butcher, and burn their way through vanquished cities. They process towards their victorious king, who's often shown standing in his chariot or sitting on an ornate throne in front of his campaign tent, watching as the wealth of the fallen is paraded before him, his accountants keeping tally as temple treasures, civic booty, prisoners, refugees, and animals file past. A particularly vivid, though damaged, example of this scene is now in the British Museum. Dated to about 730 BCE, it commemorates the defeat of an unidentified Levantine city by King Tiglath-Pileser III. The top register of the panel shows archers attacking the heavily fortified city while troops hack at the brickwork. Striding past a pile of corpses, soldiers carry off sacks of loot and a couch from an affluent home, while another herds a terrified, skittish ox out of the city. The tumult of the Assyrian raid gives way to a solemn procession in the lower register. Marching two by two, troops convey the gods of the city into exile. Carefully positioned on sturdy pallets carried on the soldiers' shoulders, the cult statues progress in stately fashion towards their new home in Assyria. Four deities in the middle of the procession are shown. A fearsome warrior god, wearing a horned crown and brandishing his weapons, follows a deity housed in a box-like shrine. Ahead of them are two enthroned deities, probably goddesses, clothed in the ankle-length tunics of royal authority. Although their feet are partially obscured by their captors' tall helmets, the towering height of the gods' thrones indicates their feet remain appropriately elevated, their divine authority intact. In a world in which even the gods of other lands were considered dangerously powerful, these statues and their temple furniture are handled with a ritualized reverence. The gods might as well be going on tour to pay willing tribute to another deity in another temple, which is precisely the way in which the capture and exile of divine statues was so often couched in ancient Southwest Asian texts and inscriptions. At the heart of this iconography is the widespread and deeply rooted sense that the imposition and maintenance of order in the earthly realm was a divinely ordained responsibility of kings who imitated their patron deities by stamping out rebellious forces and upholding the hierarchical power structures built into the world at its creation. Mortal kings might have had their footstools kicked out from under them as they were pulled from their thrones and forced to prostrate themselves at the feet of a conqueror, but even in defeat, deities continued to be accorded the honour their exalted, enthroned status demanded. Across ancient Southwest Asia, this social dynamic was borne out in the divine realm itself, where the footstool of an enthroned deity functioned as a prop in the bodily performance of power. Seated in glory on a high-legged throne, the footstool not only undergirded the deity's sure-footed presence in their temple, but emphatically elevated their feet above those of other gods and heavenly attendants who stood alongside them. This carefully staged configuration of divine bodies is well attested in the Bible, for it's what Yahweh's prophets are said to have seen. In a text drawing on traditions of the 9th century BCE, Micaiah ben Imlah declares, "I saw Yahweh sitting on his throne with all the host of heaven standing to the right and to the left of him." Centuries later, God was still holding court in the same way. In the 2nd century BCE book of Daniel, the eponymous seer endures a terrifying but flamboyant vision of the deity sitting enthroned, while 1,000,000 served him and 10,000 times 10,000 stood attending him. Standing on ceremony in the presence of an enthroned deity was a crucial piece of courtly etiquette in the world of the gods. It was a mark of collegial, collaborative respect and formally displayed a keenness to leap into action should the high god demand it. Accordingly, upon entry into the divine throne room, gods were expected first to kneel or prostrate themselves at the feet of the divine ruler and then to stand in polite, ready attendance. Poor manners or a deliberate snub might trigger the most serious of punishments. A telling example of gods behaving badly is found in the Mesopotamian myth of Nergal and Ereshkigal, the earliest known version of which is dated to the 15th or 14th centuries BCE. When the goddess Ereshkigal, queen of the underworld, sends her official representative up to the heavenly realm to attend a banquet on her behalf, she's enraged to learn that one of the gods, the ambitious, cocky Nergal, refused to rise to his feet in the presence of her vizier. "Bring him to me that I may kill him," Ereshkigal commands. In a series of unsettling twists, Nergal descends to the underworld with an army, intending to behead the goddess and seize her throne. But as they grapple in the throne room, Nergal fiercely clutching fistfuls of the queen's hair, she suddenly offers to become his wife and to share with him her underworld kingdom. He relaxes his grip and she weeps. He cries and they kiss. He wipes away her tears, accepts her offer, and is enthroned alongside her. As challenging as this myth is to the gender alert sensibilities of modern day readers, it underscores the ancient conviction that a deity's enthroned status was to be preserved at all costs. The Bible too betrays ancient anxieties about God's need to defend his throne from challengers. In a poem drawing on much older mythic tropes, a semi-divine tyrant named only as Daystar, son of dawn, ascends Saphon, a traditional name of the Levantine cosmic mountain, in an effort to unseat Yahweh in his role as the enthroned Elyon, or Most High, the title inherited from El. As he strides up the holy mountain, the trespassing tyrant mutters to himself, revealing his plot. "I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the divine assembly on the heights of Saphon. I will ascend to the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like Elyon." His punishment is swift. He's cast out of the heavens and down into the underworld, the place of the dead. His expulsion is a feature of the ancient myth Christianity later recycled in its story of Lucifer, the star-bright but rebellious fallen angel who's cast out of heaven to take up a new career as the devil. But unlike Lucifer, who goes on to enjoy a heady existence in the underworld, the tyrant of this biblical poem is subjected to further punishment. His corpse is exhumed and abandoned like loathsome carrion to be trampled underfoot. Indeed, whether divine or human, no other body was fit, quite literally, for the throne and footstool of the king of the gods. At Ugarit, on the coast of Syria, the throne of Baal on Saphon was said to be so big that appointing his potential successor proves a challenge to the council of gods. The successful candidate must be a warrior of gigantic size and enormous strength, who can run as far and fast as Baal and wield a lance with sufficient supernatural skill to defeat the most fearsome of cosmic enemies. But when the warrior god, impressively named Athtar the Awesome, is chosen to sit in Baal's place, he must suffer an embarrassing climb down. As the other deities disappointedly exclaim, "His feet don't reach its footstool, his head doesn't reach its top." Dangling feet, unfixed to their royal footstool, were dangerous in the power play of divine politics. After all, some gods were known to have been dragged from heaven by their feet. This was the fate of one of the oldest deities in the cosmos, Anu, the god of primeval heaven in Mesopotamian and Hittite cultures. According to a Hittite myth, Anu's son, Kumabi, had spent 9 years of obedient prostration at his father's feet when he decided to challenge Anu in his throne room. As Anu attempted to fly to the very tops of the heavens to escape, Kumabi caught him by his heels, pulled him down by his feet, and bit off his genitals. To lose a foothold in the divine realm was to be emasculated in the most visceral of ways. Echoes of the story found their way into Greek mythology too. When Zeus takes the throne from his father, Cronos, who had supplanted and castrated his own father, Uranus, he's challenged by the monster Typhon, who cuts the tendons from Zeus's feet and hides them in a cave in an effort to unseat him. In some traditions, it's only when his tendons are retrieved and restored to his body that Zeus can finally secure his throne. Underlying these myths was the widespread notion that the back of the foot was a point of particular vulnerability and weakness in the body, as Achilles is said to have discovered during the fabled Battle of Troy. Accordingly, the back of the foot was the place at which hierarchies of power might be disrupted. This idea finds expression in the Hebrew Bible, in which the common myth of divine usurpation is reworked in the story of Jacob, whose name means heel-taker or supplanter. Born immediately after Esau, his twin brother, Jacob emerges from the womb gripping the heel of his older sibling in an action prefiguring his later usurpation of Esau when he tricks him out of his birthright as firstborn. The book of Hosea pointedly draws a parallel with Jacob's attempt to take on God himself in a wrestling match at the river Jabbok. In the womb, he took his brother by the heel, and in his manhood, he strove with God. Whether a human, a hero, or a god, to keep one's feet fixed firmly in place, both spatially and socially, was to guard against a loss of status. One of the most vivid biblical accounts of divine usurpation is told in the books of Samuel. The story begins at Shiloh in the West Bank, where one of Yahweh's oldest temples is thought to have been located. When the Israelites go to war against the Philistines, a formidable people living along Canaan's southern coast, they suffer such a catastrophic defeat that they send word to the Shiloh temple and ask for Yahweh himself to join their ranks. "Let us bring Yahweh's Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh so that he may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." As the footstool of God, the Ark was not the wrath-filled box of Hollywood's Indiana Jones movie, but the pedestal on which the deity's feet remained fixed, even as his enthroned statue was processed about his temple, or indeed taken into battle. It's the cult statue of Yahweh that's envisaged by the biblical writers when they affirm that the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh of Hosts, who is enthroned upon the cherubim, duly entered the war camp. The arrival of the deity and his divine entourage, or hosts, prompt such a rapturous response from the Israelite soldiers that the Philistines quickly realise what's happened. "Gods have come into the camp," they cry. "Woe to us! Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods?" The answer, it soon transpires, is Dagon, in Hebrew, Dagon, one of the best-known deities across ancient Southwest Asia. The Philistines not only succeed in defeating the Israelites, but capture the ark and the deity enthroned above it, and carry it back to the city of Ashdod, where they ceremonially install it in Dagon's temple, next to his statue. As was common, the Philistines treated their sacred booty with a holy reverence. Yahweh might have been a prisoner of war, but his capture was cast as an opportunity to pay polite homage to Dagon. It was an opportunity Yahweh turned to his advantage. When the victorious Philistines return to the temple the next morning, they find Dagon flat on his face, prostrate before Yahweh's footstool. Lifting the divine statue from the temple floor, they restore it to its upright position. The following day, however, they were in for another shock. Dagon had not only fallen again, but was dismembered. The head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off upon the threshold. Only the torso of Dagon was left to him. On the battlefield, Yahweh's sure-footed presence might not have won the day, but in the temple of Ashdod, in the dangerous darkness of the night, his footstool had become a weapon of war. Dagon had not only been floored by Yahweh, but like a cosmic chaos monster, he'd been trampled and dismembered, his body parts kicked to the very edges of the sacred realm. As both his footstool and a mobile shrine, Yahweh's ark was a part of his person seemingly external to his body, but barely distinguishable from him. The two were one and the same. When Yahweh moved, so did the ark. And when the deity came to rest, the ark did too, as one biblical writer explains, citing what appears to be an ancient incantation. Whenever the ark set out, Moses would say, "Arise, O Yahweh, let your enemies be scattered and your foes flee before you." And whenever it came to rest, he would say, "Return, O Yahweh, to Israel's teeming myriads." Uncomfortable with the deification of the ark as the weaponized pedestal of Yahweh, other biblical writers endeavour to disempower its agency by demythologizing its role. The ark was carried about in ritual processions, they agreed, and it had once led Yahweh's worshippers into battle, they confirmed, but it was merely a box shrine for the Ten Commandments. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone that Moses had placed there. Written into the story of the founding of Yahweh's temple in Jerusalem, this little verse reads like special pleading, and it's at odds with the ritual refrain sung by worshippers as they watched what was likely a statue of their deity process about the city and into the temple. "Rise up, O Yahweh, and go to your resting place, you and the ark of your might." The insistence that the divine footstool was actually a specialized, if sacred, container for holy writings marks a relatively early theological assault on the body of God, whose material presence, once manifest in the Iron Age temples of ancient Israel and Judah as a divine statue or cultic object, would gradually come to be replaced in ritual by the Torah. In synagogues, which emerged only during the latter half of the Second Temple period, circa 515 BCE to 70 CE, this displacement would come to be underscored by the small ark or shrine in which the Torah scrolls were housed, which took its name from the Ark of the Covenant. But cultural memories of the ark's original role as a divine footstool or pedestal appear to have persisted, as a remarkable artifact suggests. In 2009, excavations at Migdal, ancient Magdala, on the northwestern shore of the Sea of Galilee, revealed a large synagogue dated to the mid-1st century CE. In its main room was a squat, four-footed limestone block, beautifully decorated with relief carvings of iconographic and architectural motifs seemingly drawn from the Jerusalem temple. Along its longer sides are four arched gateways, flanked by columned pillars, within which stylized palm trees stand. On one of its shorter sides, two similar gateways each house a large rosette, a symbol taking pride of place between two more palms on the stone's top. Its other short side is decorated with two more columns, a pair of amphorae, and a large menorah, standing on or behind a square object which looks not unlike the stone itself. Scholars remain uncertain as to the function of this extraordinary object, but some suspect it served either as a ritual pedestal for the Torah or as a shrine modelled on the Jerusalem temple. However it's understood, its shape is remarkably evocative of the biblical footstool of God. For many, the permanent destruction of the Jerusalem temple in 70 CE meant that synagogues inevitably became the places at which God now set his feet. It was a view that would be endorsed in an anthology of early rabbinic interpretations of the book of Exodus, probably in circulation by the end of the 4th century CE, known as Michilta de Rabbi Ishmael, in which it's claimed that wherever 10 people congregate in the synagogue, the divine presence is with them, for it's written in Psalm 82, God stands in the congregation of God. In Babylonia, then home to the largest population of Yahweh worshippers outside of Palestine, the synagogue of Shafi Yativ in the city of Nehardia was said to have been built with the very dust and stones of the Jerusalem temple itself, where God has set his feet. The synagogue community could point to a scriptural precedent. In the books of Kings, an Aramean general called Naaman had been so impressed by his encounter with Yahweh's prophet Elisha, he decided to take 2 sackfuls of Israelite earth back to Aram, the city-state of Damascus, so that he could worship the God of Israel on appropriately holy ground. There was nothing new about the idea that temple materials or sacred soil could be requisitioned and relocated for cultic service. In 689 BCE, the Assyrian king Sennacherib had destroyed the city of Babylon, but was keen to transfer the ancient prestige of Marduk's Babylonian Akitu, or New Year, temple to the Akitu temple he was constructing in Ashur. Accordingly, he says, I removed dirt from Babylon and piled it in heaps and mounds in that Akitu house. Harnessing the material power of sacred ground was one way to maintain the continuity of religious practice as the political ground shifted beneath the feet of gods and mortals. But another was to assert that the gods themselves could voluntarily abandon a temple without fear of undermining their presence in the world of their worshippers. This theological strategy would effect one of the biggest transformations in the social life of the God of the Bible. Liftoff. Resting their feet on their footstools, the feet of the gods had long embodied order, control, and hierarchy in the universe. It was a power pose of cosmic supremacy. But divine footstools also played more nuanced, emotional roles in the body language of the gods. When the late Bronze Age goddess Atherat pays a visit to her husband Ael, he's so delighted to see her that he unfurrowed his brow and laughed. He set his feet on the footstool and wiggled his toes. His footstool is pressed into performative service again when he learns that Baal is dead, having been swallowed into the underworld by Mot, the god of death. Ael is distraught. He descends from his throne and sits on his footstool, and then lowers himself from his footstool to sit upon the ground to mourn. Baal is dead. What has become of the powerful one? He cries. After Baal, I shall go down into the underworld. Coming down from his throne onto his footstool marks his ritual descent from the heavenly realm into the earthly world, the place of his feet, while his lowering from his footstool onto the ground enacts his descent from the earthly realm into the underworld. With the heavenly gods Ael and Baal out of place, the universe is catastrophically turned upside down, as Anat exclaims to Shapsh, the sun goddess. Dried up are the furrows of the fields, O Shapsh. Dried up are the furrows of Ael's fields. Baal is neglecting the furrows of the ploughland. Where is mighty Baal? Where is the prince, master of the earth? Cosmic order is only restored when Ael foresees the return of Baal and his reigns and reseats himself on the throne, pointedly setting his feet on his footstool once again. At last I can sit and rest, Ael declares, for alive is mighty Baal. In the Jerusalem temple, Yahweh's footstool also functioned as a ritual manifestation of the earthly realm upon which the deity set his feet. In some biblical texts, the divine footstool is an object so large that it subsumes both the temple and the city, rendering Jerusalem itself the giant footrest of the supersized God. Yahweh is huge in Zion, exclaims one psalmist, urging pilgrims to Jerusalem. Worship at its footstool. It's a gigantism intensely magnified in the closing chapter of the book of Isaiah, in which God's temple furniture is presented as the very fabric of the cosmos itself. Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you would build for me and what's my resting place? Yahweh bellows. Yahweh's assertion of corporeal gigantism and its follow-up question about the temple was as much a snipe at his critics as it was a boast of immense cosmic sovereignty. In 597 BCE, over a century before this particular oracle was proclaimed, the kingdom of Judah had been emphatically annexed by Nebuchadnezzar II, king of Babylonia, as he consolidated power across his newly won empire. And with vassalage came desecration. He carried off all the treasures of the house of Yahweh. He cut in pieces all the objects of gold in the temple of Yahweh, which King Solomon of Israel had made. God's golden throne and footstool were gone. Within a decade, Babylonian troops had returned, and this time they sacked the city and destroyed the very fabric of the temple. In a painfully vivid lament, a ritual singer cries out to Yahweh, "Lift up your feet because of the perpetual ruins, all that the enemy laid waste in the sanctuary. Your foes have roared within your holy place. They set up their emblems there. At the upper entrance, they hacked the wooden trellis with axes, and then with hatchets and hammers, they smashed all its carved work. They set your sanctuary on fire. They desecrated the dwelling place of your name, bringing it to the ground." Both the desecration and destruction of the Jerusalem temple threatened to shatter the mythological foundations underlying the claim that Yahweh's feet were set securely in Zion. The Hebrew Bible reflects the confusion arising from this disaster. Some, like the lamenting poet, believed Yahweh had lifted up his feet to leave his sanctuary now it had been defiled by the destructive presence of his enemies. Others assumed that the Babylonians had carried him off as a prisoner of war. Still others held that he had permanently rejected Jerusalem because his priests had failed to attend sufficiently to his needs. However it was perceived, God's feet had wandered away. "He has not remembered his footstool," wept the people of Jerusalem. Theological counterclaims quickly ensued. Among the urban elites exiled from Jerusalem to Babylonia in 597 BCE was a priest of Yahweh's temple who saw visions of God as he longed for Jerusalem. The deity had been neither defeated nor repelled, Ezekiel claimed in the book bearing his name. Instead, he insisted, Yahweh had temporarily vacated his temple ahead of the foreign invasion he himself had planned by wheeling himself out from his dwelling place on what was now his mobile throne. Ezekiel had seen it all, he said. The two cherubim flanking God's throne and footstool had become four, matching the compass of the world, and each of them now perched atop a wheel. As the cherubim lifted their wings and elevated the throne, the wheels turned, and Yahweh rolled out of his temple without lifting his feet or leaving his seat. This highly specialized, esoteric image of the enthroned deity would become a stock feature of later Jewish mysticism, entrancing ancient scholars and visionaries alike. But the wheeled throne was not a notion Ezekiel had desperately plucked from the sky, despite having seen it, he said, when the clouds of heaven had rolled open to reveal their secrets to him. The augmentations customizing Yahweh's cherubim throne were drawn from much older mythologies. Deities across ancient Southwest Asia had long employed the services of their attribute animals and attendant monsters to get them about. Some stood on the back of a lion, like the great goddesses Ishtar and Atherat, while others stationed themselves on the back of a bull, like Adad and Baal. Some ceremonies stood on a monstrous snake-headed or lion-bodied dragon, like Marduk of Babylon and Asher of Assyria, while others stood or sat enthroned upon a cherub, just like Yahweh. Upon their fantastic pedestals, the gods could travel about the heavens, parade about their cities, or settle themselves in exalted glory in their temples. As a powerful storm god, Yahweh had long been known to travel on a cherub, splitting open the skies on clouds heavy with rain and crashing into the earthly realm with a thunderous shout. He bent the heavens and came down, and a thick cloud was beneath his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew and came swiftly upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering around him, his canopy thick clouds dark with water. Out of the brightness before him there broke through his clouds hailstones and coals of fire. Yahweh thundered in the heavens. The Most High uttered his voice. The storm clouds enveloping Yahweh's cherubic mount were an especially celebrated feature of his divine vigor and were already imagined as a sky chariot. Sing to God, sing praises to his name, worshippers sang in the Jerusalem temple. Lift up the charioteer of the clouds. Yah is his name, therefore exult before him. Yahweh appears to have inherited his role and title as the charioteer of the clouds from the storm god Baal, whose skill at charging about the heavens was particularly lauded at Ugarit. Combining the throne and footstool iconography of the Jerusalem temple with the ancient motif of the cherub-riding cloud charioteer, Ezekiel's god was a deity of cosmic dynamism. Yahweh had left the temple, but he had not been toppled from his throne, and nor had he abandoned it. The high god of Jerusalem remained seated in glory, his feet fixed firmly on his footstool as he wheeled out of his city to join his exiles in Babylonia. Though I removed them far away among the nations, and though I scattered them among the countries, yet I have been a sanctuary to them, he declared. This was a deity unconstrained by traditional territorial boundaries and undefeated by the devastation of desecration. On his mobile throne, he brought the sacred space of Jerusalem to his dispossessed worshippers. A century or so later, the writer of what is now the final chapter of Isaiah thus adopted a similar strategy to downplay the destruction of the Jerusalem temple. Like Ezekiel, this prophet adapted much older mythological themes to insist that Yahweh remained enthroned, his feet reassuringly planted in the world of his worshippers, no matter where they were. But there was no need for sky chariots and cherubim to illustrate Yahweh's international reach, and no need for a man-made temple to prove his presence. Instead, the gigantism of God proved that the deity remained seated in glory. Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool, Yahweh emphatically declared. Although his temple in Jerusalem lay in ruins, Yahweh's cosmic supremacy was undiminished, and his feet were still firmly fixed in the earthly realm. The Jerusalem temple would be rebuilt in the early 5th century BCE and permanently destroyed by Titus in 70 CE. But the idea that God sat enthroned in the heavens, with his feet resting on the earth, remained irresistibly potent to many early Jewish and Christian writers. Some pressed God's boast in Isaiah into polemical service against the material trappings of temple cults. Others, however, understood the text more literally and cast the earth itself as the divine footstool of God, later prompting some rabbis and, according to Matthew's Gospel, Jesus of Nazareth, to forbid their followers from blasphemously invoking the earth in swearing ritual oaths. But several Jewish and Christian communities clearly embraced the divine corporeality presented in Isaiah and quite reasonably assumed that God's body was so gigantic it reached from earth to heaven. It was a scripturally endorsed belief that would become increasingly problematic, particularly for early Christian thinkers who preferred the divine body to take the form of Christ rather than that of a supersized deity more akin to the pagan deities of Rome. In the Greco-Roman world, a certain philosophical distaste for the earthiness of the material world, combined with an increasing spiritual preference for the abstract and the transcendent, had been percolating among the intelligentsia for some time, encouraging a re-evaluation of the nature of the divine. It was against this backdrop that the architects of early Christian doctrine sought to understand their own scriptures, in which God was often presented in disturbingly corporeal terms. In their intellectual world, Christ was the only incarnation of God. Those troublesome verses in the scriptures attesting to God's body would be smoothed, smothered, or superseded by new interpretive frameworks and some fancy philosophical footwork. A favourite tactic employed by early Christian theologians was simply to reduce all biblical references to God's body to the symbolic. When the scriptures instructed people to worship at God's footstool, it was towards the cross to which Christ's feet were nailed that worshippers were directed. Another strategy, of course, was simply to insist that biblical references to God's body parts were metaphorical and allegorical and were not to be taken literally. Reverence rather requires an allegorical meaning, wrote Clement of Alexandria, circa 150 to 215 CE. You must not entertain the notion at all of figure and motion or standing or seating or place or right or left as appertaining to the Father of the universe, although these terms are in Scripture, he said. Instead, Clement argued, the biblical ascription of body parts to God was a divinely directed accommodation to the limitations of human understanding. Some early Christian theologians navigated the disorientating portrayals of God's feet by bending and stretching the temporal dimensions in which God was understood to walk in the world. When Adam and Eve had heard God walking in the garden, it was actually the sound of Christ as the pre-existent spoken word of God moving towards them. The extent to which these theological manoeuvres were practiced by ordinary Christians is a matter of considerable debate among scholars. What is more certain, however, is that by the 3rd century CE, the Christian exegete and theologian Origen was so appalled by those who still conceived of God as a cosmic giant that he launched a scathing attack upon them in one of his famous homilies. Those carnal men who have no understanding of the meaning of divinity suppose that God has so large a body that they think he sits in heaven and stretches his feet to the earth. Rather, he argued, God could not possibly be corporeal. Influenced by his conviction that Scripture often revealed its truths on ascending levels of spiritual insight, primarily the literal, the moral, and the allegorical, Origen contended that the portrayal of God's body in Isaiah was figurative in form and allegorical in nature. It served, he claimed, to illustrate the spiritual gulf between those at the most remote part of God's providence, who were too caught up in the literal, worldly affairs of the created realm, and those at the head end of the Creator God, who sought to acquire a heavenly perfection of life and loftiness of understanding as true Christians. It was a convoluted theological abstraction that would influence Christian interpretation of this biblical text and others like it for centuries to come, reflecting an increasingly powerful conceptual shift away from an old-fashioned mythological imagination to a world in which the symbolic and the abstract were granted the highest cultural and theological status. But in rendering the realm of creation in which humans dwelt so estranged from God, Origen and those church fathers to follow in his footsteps would contribute to the ongoing theological distancing of the divine from the earthly world of human experience. In doing so, they widened the emerging fissure between the corporeal and the spiritual, and in effect, dislodged God's enormous feet from the Christian world.